Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The UN World Health Organization, or WHO, said on Monday that it's working day and night to keep medical aid flowing into Ukraine following Russia's invasion more than 2 weeks ago. The relief effort has continued despite missile attacks on at least 24 healthcare facilities, workers and patients in Ukrainian cities, which have killed 12 people and injured 34. Another key priority of the WHO relief effort is to provide support to neighboring countries' healthcare systems amid an ongoing exodus of Ukrainians fleeing the war, which is now approaching 3 million people. Supply chains have been severely disrupted, the UN Health Agency said in a statement, adding that many distributors are not operational, some stockpiles are inaccessible owing to military operations, medicine supplies are running low, and hospitals are struggling to provide care to the sick and wounded. Some 18 million people in Ukraine are believed to have been affected by the war, including 6.7 million internally displaced. Chronic and emergency needs have stretched medical facilities to breaking point, with WHO reporting that nurses have had to ventilate patients manually in hospital basements away from Russian shelling that has been condemned by the UN Rights Chief. Among the most needed life-saving supplies, the UN Health Agency has sourced oxygen and insulin, surgical supplies, anesthetic and transfusion kits to collect, test and safely transfuse blood. Staying with Ukraine, electricity has been restored to the stricken Chernobyl nuclear reactor after power was lost following the site's occupation by Russian forces on the 24th of February. Announcing the news on Sunday, the UN Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, said that the plant's backup diesel generators could now be turned off. IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi explained that there had not been any critical impact on safety, as Chernobyl's spent fuel rods have continued to be cooled by the existing water tanks. But Mr. Grossi said that he was still gravely concerned about safety and security at Chernobyl and Ukraine's other nuclear facilities. At the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, which has been under Russian control since the 4th of March, the IAEA chief said that Ukrainian technicians had been joined by Russian representatives contravening safety directives. Yemen's already dire hunger crisis is teetering on the edge of outright catastrophe, the UN warned on Monday, as new data analysis indicated potentially record food insecurity there. Today, more than 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure. An additional 1.6 million are expected to fall into emergency levels of hunger in coming months, taking the total of those with emergency needs to 7.3 million by the end of the year. Of extreme concern to humanitarians is the likelihood that the number of people experiencing catastrophic or famine-like levels of hunger will increase fivefold to 161,000 by the 31st of December. World Food Programme Executive Director David Beasley said that we are almost out of time to avoid catastrophe, and he added that unless the agency received substantial new funding immediately, mass starvation and famine will follow. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The mayor of Kyiv has declared a 36-hour curfew after a series of Russian missile strikes hit residential areas of Ukraine's capital. At least two people died when a Russian missile hit a 16-story apartment complex. Meanwhile, intense fighting raged outside the capital as the Russian advance appears to be stalled. In southern Ukraine, a convoy of 160 cars was allowed to escape the besieged coastal city of Mariupol on Monday. But Russian troops reportedly refused to allow an aid convoy into the city. An advisor to Mariupol's mayor says Russia's two-week assault has killed up to 20,000 people in the city, though it was impossible to verify the figure. Today, the prime ministers of the Czech Republic, Poland, and Slovenia are traveling to Kyiv to meet with the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. On Monday, Zelensky spoke directly to the troops invading his country, saying in Russian that they should surrender.
On behalf of the Ukrainian people, we give you a chance to live. If you surrender to our forces, we will treat you as humans have to be treated, with dignity, the way you have not been treated in your army, and the way your army doesn't treat our people. Choose.
President Zelensky is set to address a joint session of the U.S. Congress by video link Wednesday, where he's expected to ask for more lethal weapons and for the U.S. to broker a deal that would see MiG fighter jets transferred from Poland to Ukraine. Meanwhile, talks between Ukraine and Russia are resuming today. After headlines, we'll go to Ukraine for the latest. In Moscow, an employee of the main state-owned television station, Channel One, burst onto the set during Monday evening's live news broadcast holding a sign reading, "No war, don't believe the propaganda," in English and Russian. "They're lying to you here." The protester, Channel One producer and editor, Marina Ovsyannikova, appeared on screen for several seconds shouting, "Stop the war, no to war," before the camera cut away. Listen carefully.
Российский премьер подчеркнул, надо усилить сотрудничество в рамках союзного государства, а на совещании в правительстве обсуждали, как сохранить доступность.
Marina Ovsyannikova was arrested by officers with Russia's Interior Ministry. She since disappeared and reportedly has no access to legal representation. Ahead of her protest, she recorded a video saying she'd worked for years spreading Kremlin propaganda as a producer at Channel One.
I'm ashamed I allowed lies to be told on TV screens. I'm ashamed I allowed Russian people to be fooled. We were silent in 2014 when it all started. We did not go out to protest when the Kremlin poisoned Navalny. We simply watched this inhumane regime. Now the whole world has turned away from us, and the next 10 generations of our descendants will not wash away the shame of this fratricidal war. We Russians are wise and proud. It is up to us to stop this madness. Come out to protest. Do not be afraid. They cannot put all of us in jail.
As she spoke, Marina Ovsyannikova wore a necklace featuring Ukraine's national colors, blue and yellow, alongside Russia's white, blue, and red. She said her father is Ukrainian and her mother Russian. Human rights groups in Russia say 15,000 people have been arrested in anti-war protests across the country since the start of the Ukraine invasion. The Biden administration's warned China against assisting Russia with financial or military assistance in the face of devastating sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. On Monday, a U.S. delegation led by the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan met with Chinese officials in Rome, hoping to press Beijing into severing ties with Moscow. The meeting came as China's foreign ministry denied reports that the Kremlin asked Beijing for military equipment.
Recently, the U.S. has been spreading disinformation against China in regards to the Ukraine issue, time after time, with sinister intentions. China's position on the Ukraine issue is consistent and clear, and we have always played a constructive role in persuading peace and promoting talks.
The United Nations warns acute cases of hunger in Yemen have reached an unprecedented level, with over 160,000 people likely to experience famine over the second half of this year. The UN says more than 17 million people in Yemen are currently in need of food assistance, with persistent high levels of acute malnutrition among children under the age of five. The stark warning came ahead of a donors conference on Yemen planned for Wednesday. Yemen suffering the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, 7 years after the Saudi-led coalition launched its war and blockade of Yemen, backed by arms sales and technical assistance from the United States and allies, including France and the United Kingdom. Newly declassified documents reveal the CIA used a prisoner at a secret prison in Afghanistan as a training prop to teach interrogators how to torture other prisoners. Portions of a 2008 report by the CIA's Inspector General made public in court filings revealed the prisoner, Omar al-Baluchi, was repeatedly stripped naked and had his head slammed into a plywood wall by trainee interrogators who lined up to practice the technique on Baluchi for up to 2 hours at a time. The Inspector General's report revealed the torture left Baluchi with brain damage and did not yield any useful intelligence. Baluchi is still being held at the U.S. prison in Guantanamo, where he's been in pretrial hearings for 10 years on charges he participated in plotting the 9/11 attacks. Britain's highest court has rejected an appeal from Julian Assange, who's seeking to block his extradition to the United States. The ruling means British Home Secretary Priti Patel will have the final decision on whether to turn Assange over to the Biden administration. Assange faces espionage charges that could bring up to 175 years in prison after he published classified U.S. documents on WikiLeaks that exposed war crimes. Assange's lawyers argued he could face prolonged solitary confinement in a U.S. supermax prison, conditions tantamount to torture. This is Simon Crowther, a legal advisor with Amnesty International.
What it means is that non-legally binding diplomatic assurances that Julian Assange would not be tortured will not be scrutinised by the Supreme Court. This is bad for Assange, but it's also bad for justice in the UK, and it's bad for the global prohibition of torture, because this kind of agreement really needs all the scrutiny that it can get.
Julian Assange has spent over 1,000 days locked up in the Belmarsh High Security Prison in London, where he recently suffered a mini-stroke. He's scheduled to marry his fiancée, Stella Morris, inside Belmarsh on March 23rd. To see our interview with Stella Morris, you can go to democracynow.org. British lawmakers are calling on Prime Minister Boris Johnson to cancel his planned trip to Saudi Arabia for talks with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Opposition politicians and even some members of Johnson's Conservative Party cited the recent mass execution of 81 men by Saudi Arabia as the latest example of the kingdom's abysmal human rights record. Johnson has called on Saudi officials to pump more oil to bring down rising energy costs as Western countries look for alternatives to Russian oil. Last week, the White House came under fire after a report claimed President Biden is planning a visit to Saudi Arabia to, quote, help repair relations. We'll have more on the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia later within the broadcast. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has reportedly retreated from a plan to discuss the lifting of sanctions on Venezuela's oil industry. Several U.S. senators, including Florida Republican Marco Rubio and New Jersey Democrat Bob Menendez, objected after reports emerged that Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro met with American officials in Caracas earlier this month. Meanwhile, Koch Industries signaled this week it has no plans to join nearly 400 other multinational corporations that have suspended their Russian operations. The conglomerate, which is run by the billionaire Republican Party donor Charles Koch, owns at least three companies still doing business in Russia. Idaho's Republican-led legislature has approved an anti-abortion bill modeled after Texas's first-of-its-kind law that effectively bans abortions after about 6 weeks. The Idaho law allows family members of a pregnant person, as well as a potential father, to sue a doctor who performs an abortion. Those who succeed could collect $20,000 plus legal fees from the abortion provider. Under the law, a rapist could not file such a lawsuit, but a rapist's relatives could sue. This comes just days after Idaho lawmakers approved a bill that would ban puberty-blocking treatment, hormone therapy, and gender-affirming surgery for trans children. It would also make it a felony to take trans youth out of the state to receive that care elsewhere. Those found guilty face up to life in prison. Meanwhile, Mississippi Republican Governor Tate Reeves signed a bill Monday limiting how race can be discussed in classrooms. The bill garnered support only from white Republicans. All of Mississippi's black legislators opposed it and staged a walkout in January to protest it. And in a reversal, West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin said Monday he will oppose President Biden's nomination of Sarah Bloom Raskin to serve on the Federal Reserve Board. Manchin's change of position all but dooms Raskin's prospect of confirmation, which is opposed by all 50 Senate Republicans, including, most recently, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski and Maine's Susan Collins. Sarah Bloom Raskin has vowed to focus on how the climate crisis threatens the economy. Last month, Democracy Now! Asked Raskin's husband, Democratic Congressmember Jamie Raskin, why Republicans oppose her nomination.
All of this is about things that she has said or written about climate change. She has said, of course, that she will follow the law and act completely within the dual mandate of the Fed. But what they're attacking is the idea that there can be citizens who are fully aware of climate change, who take it seriously, who can serve honorably and lawfully in other capacities.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, listeners. This is Carl G. from the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m., we'll talk about prisons since the Fugitive Slave Act to the Attica Uprising to 2018 prison strike. Stay tuned for more information on strikes and rebellions wherever they occur. Only on the Abolitionist Hour on Radio Free Kansas. Every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, Russia's horrendous invasion of Ukraine is providing yet another reminder that when elephants fight, it's the grass that is trampled. We see that not just in the front page casualties, teenage soldiers dying fighting, civilian men, women, and children killed by dropping bombs, but also in the measures that we are told are meant to avert those harms, economic sanctions. Karee Peterson-Smith is the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He joins us to talk about the problem with seeing sanctions as an alternative to war. Also on the show, in March of 2012, Amazon opened a department dedicated to ferreting out tax breaks and subsidies. In other words, the mega corporation making hundreds of billions of dollars in profit puts in time finding ways to avoid supporting the communities they operate in and to push local governments to divest money from education, housing, and health care to give to a company that doesn't need it. This March, the group Good Jobs First marked that anniversary with a call to end Amazon subsidies. We'll talk with the executive director of Good Jobs First, Greg LeRoy. That's coming up, and we'll get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Russian elite can't stand the sanctions, crowed a recent piece in The Atlantic. The whine and protest from the country's oligarchs meant that the U.S. and European sanctions were, quote, working as intended to punish Russia's elites for supporting President Vladimir Putin, close quote. They won't starve, the story elaborated, but they, quote, will be unable to maintain their jet-setting luxury lifestyle, close quote. Meanwhile, CNBC viewers were told the West is trying to destroy Russia's economy, and analysts think it could succeed. That piece cited the French finance minister's statement that the aim of the latest round of sanctions was, quote, to cause the collapse of the Russian economy, close quote. So which is it? Inconvenience a few richy riches or bring a country of 145 million people to its knees? Or is there a secret way to immiserate a country without incurring grievous human harm? The current moment provides another chance to examine the role of economic sanctions in conflict. And here to help us think about that is Karee Peterson-Smith. He's the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. He joins us now by phone from Boston. Welcome back to Counterspin, Karee Peterson-Smith.
I'm so grateful to be here, Janine.
Well, thank you. Just like we're told by politicians and by media that weapons like bombs and drones are surgical and that they're targeted, we're also told that sanctions are carefully aimed to hurt only the powerful in order to influence them. Your recent writing engages that storyline because it just doesn't play out that way, does it?
It doesn't. And I think that particularly with sanctions, they're not designed to play out that way. You know, when the Biden administration first was talking about doing sanctions on Russia, they simultaneously talked about targeting Putin and a few oligarchs, and they would use phrases like, to use their language, crippling sanctions. And as you said, you can't have it both ways. You can't say that this is targeted and specific and also talk about attacking the entire Russian economy, which the kind of sanctions that they have pursued intend to take out an economy. You know, when you cut the Russian economy out of the international banking system, for example, that's not just going to affect the billionaires, that's going to affect the whole population. And as we've seen, the ruble has been crashing. So that does affect the population. So this is the design. It's how sanctions are intended.
Well, and that's kind of the heart of your piece, is the fact that sanctions are framed for kind of the public, the people who are going to be asked to support a particular invasion or a particular policy. Sanctions are framed as an alternative to war. And I hear you saying that's not just an imprecise, that's a wrong way to think about it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, the first thing is that sanctions, their impact is devastating in ways that are at least similar and often worse than armed combat. When we think about the sanctions that the U.S. imposed on Iraq in the 1990s, when we think about the decades-long U.S. embargo on Cuba, you know, these have had drastic impacts on the populations. When we think about the way that the Iranian population has been impacted right now and has been for years. The other thing, though, is that often, and actually in the three cases I just named, Iran, Iraq, and Cuba, the U.S. government deploying sanctions is not posing them as an alternative to military action. It actually combines them with military action. So we know that the U.S. embargo on Cuba has coincided with various attempts to overthrow the Cuban government since the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s were bookended by U.S. invasions in 1991 and 2003. And then with Iran, the sanctions that have been imposed for several years, for many years, coincide with all kinds of military pressure as well. And Trump was maybe the most honest about this. Folks will remember his maximum pressure regime, which was a combination of intense sanctions and parking aircraft carriers off the coast of Iran, threatening airstrikes, and so on. So the actual practice is to really combine sanctions and combat or kind of armed force. They're really just tools in the same toolbox.
When folks are transparent about it, they will say that sanctions are aimed at regime change. And that's what I often talk about, is kind of accepting the U.S. legitimacy and changing the leadership of other countries is the price of admission to serious people conversation about geopolitics and news media, you know.
Right.
You don't have to concede the right of global powers like the U.S. to force regime change. But even beyond the illegitimacy of that goal, sanctions don't appear to work toward that end.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the first thing, which you said, is so important, because it's a pretty incredible thing that policymakers, U.S. officials, and journalists in mainstream media talk openly and casually about how the intended impact of sanctions is to immiserate a country's population such that they overthrow the government in a way that is favorable to the United States. And if that isn't shocking, then I ask people to consider what it would be like or how the U.S. government would react if that kind of conversation was happening casually in Moscow or in other countries that the U.S. deems as enemies. It's really incredible that U.S. officials demonize Putin for being undemocratic, which certainly he's undemocratic.
Absolutely.
But to support overthrowing the government, and not just support it rhetorically, but pursue a policy whose thinly veiled objective is that, it's a profoundly anti-democratic act. But as you say, as wrong as the intention is, it's also been ineffective. I mean, the U.S. has had sanctions on Cuba for how many decades? And that government remains in power. If anything, sanctions tend to strengthen the government that the U.S. is targeting. When the U.S. imposed sanctions on Iraq, for example, again, with the hope that that would lead to a coup within Iraq against Saddam Hussein's regime, because of the way that the Iraqi economy was devastated and the resulting limited access to things like food and medicine, it made Iraqis more dependent on the Iraqi government, actually, and so it strengthened that government for what it's worth. So, you know, the U.S. has no right anyway to meddle in the affairs of another country's society, to target not only the country's population, but the most vulnerable people in the population, who's always the people who lose when the U.S. imposes sanctions. But also, for what it's worth, it's an ineffective approach.
Well, U.S. media translating into what they imagine as news you can use for their U.S. audience. I saw an op-ed in the Detroit News by a former diplomat that said that the West needed to pull together to, quote, change Putin's path, close quote, and that, quote, that unity may well depend on the willingness of citizens of the West to suffer some economic costs of the broad economic sanctions. If inflation or gas prices go up and your 401k goes down as a result, give some thought to what democracy is worth to you, close quote. Well, there's a lot going on there, obviously.
There is.
I mean, you know, that could take us all day. But let me just say, all right, let's think about what democracy means to us, and also international solidarity and human rights and justice and sustainability and peace. Let's think about those things. What could we be thinking about as other ways forward in what is admittedly a frightening time?
Right. Well, I think that the way you're putting things in an international context, and I think that's extremely important, because while U.S. officials and U.S. media cast countries that they deem as enemies as so foreign that you couldn't possibly relate to them, that there's something about Russia, right, or something about Iran or something about China, there's something about the kind of internal nature of those societies. When we talk about Iran, there's these Islamophobic tropes or something about those people, that, you know, democracy is a problem and the only solution is for democracy to be imposed by the United States and the West. And let's remind ourselves that among the many things happening in this country, we had an armed attack on the Capitol last year led by an outgoing president who refused to accept the election results. We have an open campaign by the Republican Party to pass laws to restrict democracy, democratic rights at the state level, targeting the people who are always targeted, black people, other people of color, immigrants, and so on. Right. And so there are plenty of problems in terms of democratic rights here. And the notion that there's something exceptional about Russia that requires the U.S. to step in and do something, whereas this is a bastion of democracy, is false. And instead, I think that we, the people, you know, the ordinary people of this place and of the world, need to ask, what are we all doing within and across borders to make a more democratic world? I'll have to say I'm quite inspired by the people in Russia dissenting against this war in their thousands in cities across the country. They are pointing the way in terms of democracy, not only in Russia, but actually they're pointing the way for all of us. So what are we doing to build popular democracy, in other words? And the challenge of having more democratic societies is not a Russian challenge. It's not an Iranian challenge or a Chinese challenge. It's also a U.S. challenge. It is a challenge that we are facing all across the world. I mean, I think that it means a very different orientation that we have to have.
All right, then. Well, we'll end there for now. We've been speaking with Curry Peterson-Smith. He's the Michael Ratner Middle East Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. And his article, "Sanctions May Sound Nonviolent, But They Quietly Hurt the Most Vulnerable," can be found at truthout.org. Curry Peterson-Smith, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you. It's an honor.
If
It's meaningful that Amazon's head, Jeff Bezos, also owns the Washington Post, and that the paper sometimes needs to be reminded to disclose that relationship to readers as they run stories like Jeff Bezos blasts into space on own rocket, best day ever, buttressed by op-eds like the billionaire's space efforts may seem tone-deaf, but they're important milestones. The difficult reality is that Bezos doesn't need to outright own a news outlet to get coverage that undergirds his worldview. That, yes, it makes sense for a man to launch himself into space while some of his employees rely on public assistance to feed themselves and face every underhanded obstacle if they try to organize. And for a company that contains those contradictions to be labeled a wild economic success. Corporate news media aren't the first place to look for critical examinations of corporate capitalism, but they do present themselves as watchdogs of the public interest, and especially public spending, the cost to taxpayers. If that's true, a hard look at public subsidies to Amazon should be compelling stuff. Here to tell us about it is Greg LeRoy, Executive Director of Good Jobs First, the group behind the End Amazon Subsidies campaign. He joins us now by phone from Maryland. Welcome back to Counterspin, Greg LeRoy.
Thanks, Janine. Great to be with you.
Well, simply enough, how do you describe to people the problem that the End Amazon Subsidies campaign is aimed at?
I think everybody understands now that Amazon is kind of like metastasizing.
Right.
It's now the number one retailer by dollar volume in the United States. It leapfrogged Walmart a couple of years ago. It's massively growing its warehouse network because pandemic deliveries surged. You know, they've added hundreds of new warehouses during the pandemic and are still adding more. As if Amazon was ever a small company 20 years ago and might have needed some help, we've passed that Rubicon eons ago, right? This is a very aggressive, very rapidly growing company with lots of other tentacles that people don't know very much about, like cloud computing and fashion and movies and groceries, obviously, and many other things. But 10 years ago, this month, marks the anniversary when the company basically set up a part of its public policy department charged with doing nothing but getting tax breaks, because the company now was in a growth mode where it was going to have to build lots of warehouses, you know, next to every major market with lots of prime households, and therefore they wanted to get paid to do that. And the company has pulled down more than $4.1 billion already, mostly for warehouses, sometimes for data centers and other things, but mostly warehouses all over the country. And we think that's nuts.
It's money coming from public coffers to support what is not a fledgling, struggling business that,
right,
that requires that kind of lift. Well, tax avoidance is never an accident at Amazon, right? It's always been a
right,
conscious part of their model. We're talking now about moving from tax avoidance to subsidies, but from the get-go, they have not been interested in supporting the state or the community that they function within.
That's exactly right. I mean, and it's not wrong to think of these economic development incentives or subsidies as another form of tax avoidance, because it means you're avoiding paying your property taxes for 10 or 20 years. It means you're not paying sales tax on your new building materials and machinery and equipment. It means you might be getting an income tax credit back because you invested X dollars or hired X people. So many of these deals involve multiple tax breaks of the normal kinds of taxes that a family would pay otherwise, for example, and a company should pay.
And then from the community, the government point of view, and I saw this, your colleague Kenneth Thomas quoted in this report in Vice, you know, it's worth just saying it out loud that the money that these communities are giving to Amazon, they could have put into education or healthcare or infrastructure or a million other things.
That's exactly right. Education obviously is the most expensive local public service and is usually the biggest dollar loser. But everything that takes place at the local level, county public health programs, infrastructure, whether we're not going to reduce class size or have pre-kindergarten classes, all those things are affected by the amount of money available. And when a big company comes in like Amazon and doesn't pay much, if anything, toward all the growth that's being induced, guess who gets socked with lousier public services and higher taxes?
And that's not even to mention the displacement or the harm to smaller and local businesses who just can't compete because they're paying their taxes. They're not getting the same kind of break necessarily that a behemoth like Amazon is able to finagle.
That's right. We've been saying for years, communities and states should not pay Amazon to arrive. It should be the other way around. Amazon should pay for the privilege of arriving because of the damage it's going to do to the local economies.
Well, another aspect that should be catnip for reporters is the secretiveness. The Chicago Tribune ran a piece by Pat Garofalo from the American Economic Liberties Project about how, for instance, when Amazon got more than $100 million in tax breaks in 2020 from a village in Illinois, they demanded that the trustees wouldn't disclose that Amazon was behind the deal until the deal was basically a foregone conclusion. So the community didn't get to weigh in on this massive deal. I mean, what's up with that?
Well, and a similar thing happened in Fort Wayne, Indiana, right next door, where in the first phase tax abatement, the council literally didn't know they were approving a property tax abatement for Amazon. And then on the second bite, by the time the company's name had come out, they voted it down, but the company stayed anyway, despite a threat. I think Amazon knows there's something wrong with this. They've gotten more secretive in recent years. We've noted that. Our tracker on our website has multiple lines now saying, you know, amount unknown or amount incomplete, because they're working very aggressively with public officials to try to cover up something. Maybe they feel dirty about it. I can only speculate.
Well, and yeah, sunshine is always going to be the best disinfectant there. And just one note on that Chicago Tribune piece, Garofalo also noted that in the case he was talking about, funds came disproportionately from black neighborhoods. And that's another problem with these non-disclosure agreements. Different corporations can make different demands of different localities, and some might have to pay more than to host a facility than others, but they don't know that because it's all shrouded in secrecy.
Yes, and Amazon, classic, you know, secretive whipsawing of communities against each other, putting public officials in what's known as a prisoner's dilemma in game theory, where they don't know who they're competing against. They don't know if what the company is telling them is truthful about bids from other places. And in the case Pat was talking about, this is a fantastic investigation by WBEZ Radio in Chicago and something called the Better Government Association, where they really dug in and found very sharp racial disparities between the company's treatment of different communities.
A story on CBS Money Watch last year cited your work, Good Jobs First, and the critique of Amazon subsidies, and they had a counter, not much of one, but, you know, sort of halfway through the piece, it says, quote, Amazon defends its use of subsidies, pointing to its hiring record and saying that the tax breaks are available to all companies, close quote. What do you say?
You know, it's not wrong to say that too many of these tax breaks are available to too many companies. Mm-hmm. But that's a problem. That's a big structural recurring problem we've been screaming about for 20 years. That is, once you make a program like an abatement program basically a gimme, on nearly an automatic, or a tax increment financing district or an enterprise zone, or, you know, name your poison, then sure, rich companies with armies of consultants and accountants and tax experts are going to come in and grab every piece of money laying on the table they can.
Yeah.
That's the big structural problem with incentives these days.
That doesn't make it a good thing, you know.
Right. Exactly.
It's not really
doesn't
a defense.
Excuse it.
You know, and you know, I get in a cynical way why Amazon or any company wants to scrounge and scrape and withhold in order to hold on to every thin dime. What I don't understand is how anyone can make that part of their free enterprise fairy tale, you know, like it's a better mousetrap, and if you work real hard, you can do it too. You know, that's the part I object to. Amazon is doing something that really only Amazon can do at this point. I guess what I'm saying is I don't understand why this is presented as an example of capitalism working as it should. You know, someone's got a great idea and was able to make it bigger and bigger and bigger, and so, you know, then they get to launch themselves into space.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you read the comment threads on some of these articles, there certainly are some people that say, like, what are you belly aching for? You know, this is capitalism. Everybody does it. But I also think it suggests that capitalism is kind of fragile. I mean, you look at developers who always expect breaks of many different kinds, not just retail developers, and you ask yourself, like, if these things just weren't legal, if they expected to pay, you know, full freight for coming in, they would still do it, right? The markets are still there. The spending power is still there. The jobs are still need to be housed, whatever the project is.
Right.
We've allowed companies to just assume they're not going to pay to arrive.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real weakness in both public policy but also corporate mentality.
And haven't there been instances where communities have said, you know, they think Amazon would have located the warehouse there for basic economic reasons, even without the subsidy. So it was, you know, not just not necessary to go into Amazon's coffers, but they had reasons to locate there outside of that.
Well, we have a great deal of evidence. We have an interactive story map on our website where we've updated it with all the new pandemic warehouses. And the recurring theme is proximity to affluent zip codes with lots of prime households, although not in the prime households because land's so expensive, you know, two or three ramps out on the highway, near an airport, near a railhead, near a truck depot, and in a warehouse district close to affluent zip codes. It's really predictable where they're going to go.
Well, just finally, there are communities that push back that don't see Amazon as a gift from the gods arriving in their in their town, you know, and who actually resisted and have done so successfully. And we didn't even touch on the fact that Amazon is doing this around the world. We're not just talking mm-hmm. about the United States. They're getting subsidies in every country they can. But also around the world, folks are resisting it.
It's true. I mean, this new damning findings by Reuters about their behavior toward third-party vendors in India that just spawned the letter from five members of Congress to the Department of Justice asking them to look at Amazon's potential lying to Congress about their behavior toward third-party vendors. You're right. This is a global story.
All right, then. We've been speaking with Greg LeRoy. He's executive director at the group Good Jobs First. You can find their work, including around ending Amazon subsidies, online at goodjobsfirst.org. Greg LeRoy, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find shows and transcripts on our website, FAIR.org. That's also the place to learn about our newsletter Extra or to sign up for our Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
The mayor of Kyiv has declared a 35-hour curfew after a series of Russian missile strikes hit residential areas of Ukraine's capital. At least two people died when a Russian missile hit a 16-story apartment complex. This comes as the prime ministers of the Czech Republic, Poland, and Slovenia traveled to Kyiv to meet with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Talks are also resuming today between Ukraine and Russia. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate end to the war.
Ukraine is on fire. The country is being decimated before the eyes of the world. The impact on civilians is reaching terrifying proportions. Countless innocent people, including women and children, have been killed. after being hit by Russian forces, roads, airports and schools lie in ruins. According to the World Health Organization, at least 24 health facilities have suffered attacks. Hundreds of thousands of people are without water or electricity. And with each passing hour, two things are increasingly clear. First, it kept getting worse. Second, whatever the outcome, this war will have no winners, only losers.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. We go now to Ukraine, where we're joined by Peter Zolmayev, the director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative, joining us from outside of Kyiv. Peter, welcome to Democracy Now! You have this emergency curfew that has just been imposed, what is it, 35, 36 hours. Can you describe what you're experiencing right now in your community?
Well, the curfew being imposed by the mayor is definitely is clearly designed to prevent from any provocations inside. You know, we now have information that weeks prior to the invasion, Russians have sent their diversionary groups, you know, so these clandestine cells to infiltrate the Ukrainian cities, particularly Kyiv. There have been a few dozen identified during the first, you know, phase of the war when there was an attack on Kyiv, an attempt to take Kyiv by force. Several of these, numbering the hundreds, were neutralized, by which I mean destroyed. But the fear is that there's still a lot of them there, and they will try to, to attack from the inside. And so Kyiv is living relatively, considering that we have two, three rocket attacks per day now. It's already getting normalized, the idea that the capital of Ukraine is getting rocket attacks and a few people die every day. It's still not on the scale, thank God, of Mariupol, where there are thousands reported dead. So overall, I would say that the situation is, and there's no panic necessarily. The steady flow of evacuees, you know, is proceeding, but about a half of the pre-war population of Kyiv remains, which is about 2 million people.
Peter, you were predicting that Putin would invade in early February, when most people were saying he wouldn't dare do this at this extensive level of the whole country. Why did you think this? And talk about what exactly this means for the population of Ukraine. Of course, he expected, like Rumsfeld did when the U.S. invaded Iraq, to be met with flowers and applause. To say the least, this not only has happened, but it has brought together perhaps a very fractured society.
Well, indeed, you know, this Vladimir Putin's miscalculation is pretty glaring. You know, he constantly is trying to poke America in the eyes with what he claims is hypocrisy, such as going to Iraq under false pretenses in 2003, and then building unrealistic expectations, like you said, about how they would be greeted, such as greeted by the liberators. Well, Putin is, you know, whatever he claims about the U.S., you know, misadventures in the Middle East, he seems to be repeating the same mistakes. You know, he miscalculated the strength of the resistance, the morass that he would sink into, and the willingness of Ukrainians to greet Russians as liberators. That has not panned out like that. So when I was saying in February that the invasion was coming, it was obviously clear that for Vladimir Putin to back down after having amassed 200,000 troops on the borders of Ukraine would have been political suicide, just as much as it is for him now to sort of roll back his troops is tantamount to, you know, political and also physical suicide, almost, I would say. That's why you hear this talk about the need to find an off-ramp for Vladimir Putin so he can announce victory. That's a separate, subject for conversation, whether that should be happening. When you talk about if you ask me about Ukrainian society, what it has done to the Ukrainian society, well, first of all, almost 3 million people have fled Ukraine. But just judging from what I'm seeing driving around, I've driven hundreds of miles around Ukraine in the last two or three weeks. I have not seen that level of national consciousness ever in my life. I mean, the only precedent for that would be the World War II in 1940s. I mean, this is as black and white an issue for Ukrainians as it's ever been. No shades of gray here. It was a war for liberation. It's a war for freedom. I mean, normal in peaceful times, I would sort of shy away from these terms. It's too lofty, maybe almost cheesy, you know, if you allow me. But I mean, these are the terms in which we think right now. We look at the invading hordes. We call them orcs, sort of like in the Tolkien language. We call Russia Mordor. It's actually now accepted. I mean, you hear it from Russia, from Ukrainian TV presenters. This is sort of the semi-official way to describe what we're seeing. And the barbarity to which Vladimir Putin's troops have resorted in bombing our city centers, our infrastructure, the damage is estimated upwards of $100 billion already. It is all clear that they're not having any military successes. So they're just bent on revenge and anger that they're venting on civilians.
Peter Zamayev, you actually are from Donetsk. Can you talk about what's happening there?
It's, you know, it was kind of quiet for a while because of the front line there. Having existed in place since 2014, was the most fortified. That's why you see this incredible battle for Mariupol. I mean, I wouldn't be at liberty to venture a guess how many fighters are still there, but the invading force that has encircled Mariupol is infinitely bigger, and yet they're not having, I mean, they're killing civilians, but they're not achieving their goal. They have yet to take a major population center anywhere in Ukraine, with the exception of Kherson, which every day you have sporadic pro-Ukrainian rallies there, and they can't put them down. So coming back to Donetsk, it was relatively quiet, and then the quiet was shattered yesterday when a rocket apparently was blown off the skies and landed in a right smack in the center of the city next to one of my apartments. I own several apartments which have been sitting empty there this whole time. And one of them blew out all the windows in the apartment. The person who's been watching over the apartment just called me and told me that, you know, it's looking pretty bad. It was large devastation, and as many as 20 people were killed. We're not sure which rocket it was. A true fog of war situation. And so here you go.
We're hearing numbers as high as 20,000 dead in Mariupol in the south. Is that possible?
Yes, I heard this as well. I would doubt that figure. We're talking definitely several thousand. The last I heard was 2,000 to 3,000. 20,000 may be an exaggeration, even though, you know, that's shaky ground. You're trying to question the figures by people who are there. So I don't believe it's 20,000, but we're definitely talking 3,000 or so. And if that is the case, and if the situation, if the trends sort of, you know, continues the same way, we are going to see the worst kind of, you know, worst case scenario that was actually mentioned by a German tabloid Bild right before the war, which actually, I'll be honest with you, outraged me. I could not believe that this would be our reality. But actually, it's, you know, it predicted as many as 50,000 civilian deaths. So far, I can't tell you the, you know, we're talking maybe up to 5,000 civilian deaths in the country. But considering that Vladimir Putin has not shown any decrease in appetite bombing us, I mean, you know, just God knows how much more casualties we will suffer.
Peter Zamayev, you mentioned the off-ramp for Putin. What do you see that could be, and what would be acceptable to the people of Ukraine?
Well, an off-ramp, obviously, he's seeking, at least on paper, he's seeking for that Ukraine declare a neutral status, a sort of Finlandization. That's sort of been bandied about, this term, and an official decision to stop pursuing NATO membership. I think those are very doable. I do not believe they're really what have been motivating Vladimir Putin in Ukraine. I think it's a very old school 19th century war of subjugation, war of land conquest that we're seeing from Vladimir Putin, the guy who does not use internet and is very much mired in his old kind of old school thinking of military glory and conquest. But at least on paper, their official, you know, displeasure has been NATO expansion, as you know, all along. That is something Ukraine has already sent signs it's willing to compromise on. I think it is willing to announce it will be neutral you know, basically move away from NATO membership process. But once again, whether that will satisfy Vladimir Putin, I'm not sure, because also connected with it are security guarantees that Ukraine needs to get from Russia in return. In 1994, Budapest memorandum was signed, according to which Ukraine would be, you know, turned over its nuclear weapons in exchange for security guarantees. Well, we're seeing now how much worth that paper was worth that it was written on, the Budapest memorandum. So what kind of security guarantees will Ukraine receive this time? Vladimir Putin wants to establish a new status quo, get more of Ukraine's territory. Ideally, he wants to cut Ukraine off from all access to the sea and then start negotiating. Well, that's not a viable construct for Ukraine. I do not think so. So, and Vladimir Putin, once again, keep in mind, whatever paper you sign, whatever agreement you reach, the Russian side has shown that it cannot be trusted.
Peter, you are a television host, and I'm wondering if you can talk about the meaning of what just happened in Moscow. You have the state TV employee, a longtime producer there, who stood up behind the presenter and held a no war sign in English and Russian. She had issued also, had prepared in advance, her name is Marina Ovsyannikova, a statement where she was wearing a necklace that is red and white and blue and yellow for the Ukraine and Russian colors. And she's disappeared. Seems that she has been arrested. It is not clear. People have not been in touch with her. The significance of this protest and also of the mass Russian anti-war protests, what does that mean to you as a Ukrainian?
Well, it means quite a bit. You know, we are definitely worried about this this lady, a journalist, our colleague. Keep in mind, Russia has just passed this draconian law that envisions 15 years in prison term for just such actions as you mentioned by this reporter. 15 years in jail for daring to criticize the government and its conduct in Ukraine, even calling it a war, may land you in prison, simply because the Russian side refuses to call it what it is, and the official term for it is special operation. I am doubtful as to this having necessarily a domino effect, even though since then we've heard one very well-known anchor on another channel has stepped down since. But as far as leading to a domino effect, you know, and also trying to overcome this informational blockade that Vladimir Putin has imposed on Russia, that is doubtful. That is a one-off, I think, you know, and that's actually led in Ukraine to, you know, suspicions about, you know, the motivation of this and who the owner of the channel is and how maybe they are trying to position themselves to win an indulgence in the West, to be able to flee to the West, to not have sanctions placed against them, you know, to point to this lady and say, well, see, this is what we did. I mean, all kind of cynicism about this. I want to take this at its face value, and I would just say that what this lady did is really hard to understand for anyone who is not in Russia.
Peter Zamayev, I want to thank you for being with us, director of the Eurasia Democracy Initiative. Finally, we just have 10 seconds, but the significance of the prime ministers of Poland, Slovenia, as well as Czech Republic coming to meet with Zelensky in Ukraine's capital, where you are in Kyiv?
An incredible vote of confidence in Kyiv, in Ukraine, and the ability of Ukrainians to hold their capital, to defend it, a show of support. We need as much of that as we can.
Peter Zolmayev, thank you so much for being with us, hosting a television program in Ukraine based just outside of Kyiv. Coming up, Josh.
Germany was having trouble. What a sad, sad story. Needed a new leader to restore its former glory. Where, oh, where was he? Where could that man be? We looked around and then we found a man for you and me. And now in
springtime for Hitler and Germany, Deutschland is happy and gay.
We're marching to a faster pace. Look out, here comes the master race. Springtime for Hitler and Germany.
Born in Dusseldorf, and that is why they call me Rolf.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty. Come and join the Nazi party.
Germany, my good, well, that's a little flashback there for you listeners, a little flashback that is well worth the time. We got John Grant on the horn in the second hour.
Hey, Mike.
Can't be happening radio on Tuesday. Hey, John.
How you doing?
What do you think, brother? Okay.
Well, it's good. We got nice spring weather here. You know, it's comfy, very nice. It was like in the 20s 3 days ago, and yesterday was beautiful.
Yeah.
So it's... We're being whipsawed around as usual.
Yeah. Well, that's 60. It's going to be 65 today and 74 tomorrow, according to the weather predictors here in Kansas. So.
Oh yeah, we got that.
I think it's springtime.
Yeah, the crocuses are coming up, and spring is coming, baby.
Hats off to, what's his name, Mel Brooks? The guy who I think...
Mel Brooks. Mel Brooks, one of the great filmmakers. He made Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles in the same year.
I did not
of the great funny satire movies. You know, Blazing Saddles is one of my favorites. You know, it's just Cleavon Little, Randolph Scott Sheriff arrives in town, you know, Cleavon Little with his Gucci saddlebags, you know, it's like.
What was it? Who was he married to? Because you would never think he was married, Mel Brooks, but the funniest part
He's married to Mrs. Robinson. From Graduate.
What is her?
What's her name?
What is her name? She's hot. She was hot.
I can't think. Anne Bancroft.
It'll come.
Anne Bancroft, right? I believe. Yeah. I believe it's Anne Bancroft. Hottie, right?
She had her days, man. Well, you got your fact checker right there in the background.
I think she had an Academy Award for that Helen Keller movie, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Oh, they have the Miracle Worker. Yeah.
Yeah, I think she was
with
the teacher.
Yeah.
And she was Mrs. Robbins, of course. Yeah.
She was hot. Boy, that was hot. I remember going to the driving 22 miles to a theater just to look at her legs.
Oh, I can see. You were really smitten there. I can see,
Well, that and when Dustin Hoffman walked out to the swimming pool and a guy yelled about plastics as a future.
Yeah, right.
Boy, he had that right. Plastics.
Right.
It's plastic.
And, many of us as young men, we had our own Mrs. Robinsons in our lives, And,
exactly.
This is how you're initiated into the big world,
So is it springtime for Hitler and Russia?
Uh-huh.
Is it springtime for Putin? Is it springtime for Putin and Russia, you think?
Well, I don't know. According to the much dreaded New York Times, top story here is Beijing sees one victor in war, it's China. In other words, in this three-way sort of, playing each other off each other between the United States, Russia, and China, which is not new. That three-way has been going on for a long time. In the Cold War, that was always kind of an issue. They're playing off each other. It's now big time. China is playing footsie in this. It's so-so supporting Russia, but at the same time, it's really not going to send it weapons like Russia has asked, I guess. And it's being very, very cagey to preserve its power because China, according to this very interesting piece in the paper today, analyzing it, China really has its shit together and sees United States and Russia as both in their differing ways declining powers. And so it's almost like China's over there rubbing its hands together in glee. It's just trying not to get any of it on it while still not totally alienating the U.S. for, Cold War sort of way and not dissing Russia enough to cause a problem, but sort of staying arm's length from them. So it thinks that it's going to come out smelling like a rose, and these two declining powers are going to, start battering each other enough to damage themselves, and China will sort of come out of this period episode. In the catbird seat, as we were talking, that, anyway, that's the analysis. And of course, a lot of it's speculative. We'll see what happens,
So it is an editorial opinion.
This is a front page story. I mean, it's not even labeled as an analysis. It's just,
Who wrote it? Who wrote the damn thing?
Stephen Lee Myers and Chris Buckley. They're just reporters.
Oh, wow.
And here's the lead. The war in Ukraine is far from over, no shit, but a consensus is forming in Chinese policy circles, that one country stands to emerge victorious from the turmoil, and it's China. After a confused initial response to Russia's invasion, China has laid the building blocks of a strategy to shield itself from the worst economic and diplomatic consequences it could face and to benefit from geopolitical shifts over the once the smoke clears. And apparently China has decided to, you know, virtually go along with the U.S. embargo, financial embargo stuff, you know, so it doesn't, you know, really diss the United States in that sense. So it's the inscrutable East, the inscrutable Asians, the inscrutable Orientals, you know, yeah. Dr. Fu Manchu, the yellow peril, you know. it's the inscrutable Chinese, you know, there they are, and they're being as inscrutable as they're always reputed to be. So anyway, that's my joke, but it seems to be that's happening, you know.
Yeah, I only know that there were some overtures made allegedly by Russia to buy weapons or something from China.
Right.
And that Biden, or there was some statement out of the for the U.S. government against doing that and cautioning. It's so nuanced. It really is a fog of war.
Well,
would you agree?
That's
on that?
The Chinese policy this is sketching out is nuanced, or the word I prefer is inscrutable, which is the term that we used to refer to for the Chinese. And I think it still has some application, you know. It's like, you know, you look at Xi, this big, broad, square face, right? And it's he's got just as much of poker face as Putin does. And he always looks a little pained, you know, in this face. He's got a big, broad face. He always looks a little like pained. There's, you know, like his liver hurts or something, you know. You realize, my God, this guy is juggling. You know, he's juggling more than Putin and Biden are themselves, you know. I mean, this guy is sitting on a monster, you know, and a monster that's just bursting at the seams, you know, China. It's all pretty incredible, actually, when you think about it. Yeah.
Well,
here we are.
There's been so much censoring.
Yeah,
Censoring in Russia and corporate censoring here in the United States.
Oh,
I mean,
absolutely.
RT America was first. They were just censoring in Europe, and now they've turned it off. YouTube has censored it, and I don't know, maybe other corporate media.
So YouTube turned off RT.
Yeah. It's totally off.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I follow it because that's, I consider
right.
For right or wrong, for better or worse, I consider it sort of like, you know, like on YouTube, I'll go to BBC, Deutsche Welle, the German broadcast, Canadian. I go to the Canadian.
Uh-huh.
I check them all, Australia. Check them all out. And RT is totally gone. They censored. First, they censored YouTube. We're talking about YouTube. Censored certain shows.
Right.
And then, like Lee Camp, who I actually know, who I've had several times on Radio Free Kansas, Lee Camp, the comedian, his show was censored. And then I got to paying attention. He had a show called Redacted Tonight on RT America.
Okay.
And I was like, wow. And I got a frantic email from Lee Camp saying, well, they've done it. They've shut his show down after 8 years.
Wow.
And so he's doing he's trying to pick up in the aftermath of it. And I want to give listeners, you can still, you know, I'm far be it for me to promote corporate media and through YouTube, but you can still get, and I do check into it, For war analysis, CGTN. It's called CGTN.
Mm-hmm.
And what it is, it's the Chinese news media. And you can go on there, and they're still on. YouTube.
Wow.
And they have live hookups, and they've got some really interesting, you're talking about the inscrutable Chinese.
Inscrutable, yeah. Exactly.
They have a live hookup to Maidan Square in Kiev, Ukraine. A live hookup.
Wow.
You can watch it. It's sort of wild. I mean, you're watching it in real time. And then they have news analysis programs with mainly people, Chinese journalists and whatnot. And they have Chinese journalists in Ukraine embedded. I wouldn't say they're embedded with the Ukrainians, but but they're there and they're reporting on the and they're reporting.
Yeah,
on the
they're just trying to remain neutral, I guess, in that sense. Yeah.
I guess
as reporters, trying to figure out the story.
Yeah. Yeah, so for us YouTubers who are cable cutters, you know, I would suggest the listeners to check out CGTN. Now, it's sort of interesting. I will tell you the live Ukraine hookup, it's sort of I call it a death watch, but they play this classical music in the over the whole thing because it's boring. I mean, there's nothing going on. Maybe it's changing, but there was nothing. I mean, there wasn't even smoke on the horizon of bombers or bombings going on the outskirts of Kiev, Ukraine.
Right.
It was boring. So they put on some music. It was it's really funny. They have a live chat mode, and you can read what people around the world are writing. You never know who they are. And
of course,
that's
the nature of the internet: anonymity, and you know, you have phony names, and you don't know who the hell you're talking with.
Yeah. Not me. I'm dumb.
I know you, Mike. Yeah, I mean, we're up front here. No pseudonyms here.
I link to my Radio Free Kansas YouTube channel, which has no subscribers.
Well, I don't even know about it. I'll subscribe.
Well, I think that's why I don't get doxed or messed with, because they just they go to my Radio Free Kansas YouTube channel, and there's nothing there. They just are like, well, how am I going to – this guy obviously –
Well, hold up. If you have a YouTube channel, do you put YouTube pieces up or what? Or you just pass them on or what?
I pass them on. I have another channel with YouTube under my name, and that's where you and I have several programs that I've captured and uploaded to YouTube. So that's where
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I'm thinking of moving those programs, what few programs you and I have on YouTube over to Radio Free Kansas. This is before, you know, I started that experimenting. I didn't really know. I still don't really know what I'm doing, but whenever I get on their chat lines, I use Radio Free Kansas because some of these channels have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that watch it. And when I go on radio, I'm just promoting the show, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm – but anyhow, CGTN is an interesting perspective. It's sort of like it's sort of like reading the New York Times on YouTube, but except for it's Chinese New York Times.
Right.
Big media.
CGTN.
Yep. I mean, what do you think of this RTM? What do you think it's proper for the YouTube corporate internet services to censor these? I mean, is it proper or is it what?
That's a good question, because I just don't know. You know, I know people who are, you know, do things with RT. Couple people, and you know, that's the trouble with this kind of situation. You know, Russia invading Ukraine, which is a country that has, in its own mind, established itself as a sovereign country. It doesn't think it's anything else, you know, just because it used to be part of Russia. Times change. But at the same time, Russia has now decided it's not a nation. It's basically an insurgency that it's going to crush. And, you know, the United States has hooked its wagon to Ukraine, obviously, for all that NATO stuff and which people go on and on about. So basically it's a war. And so the United States has hitched its wagon to one side of this war, and we're in a war for probably the first time, very closely at war with a, you know, former, you know, first world enemy, you know. This is new. This isn't Iraq, Afghanistan, or Vietnam, which are colonial wars, which the United States was, you know, turning colonial wars into an imperialist war, you know, which is our shtick. But so this is different, and taking sides in this is different because it's not like, even my friend and jokingly in Atlanta says, you know, that during the Vietnam War he was for the Viet Cong, and he, you know, against my buddies and I, and, you know, we always joke about this, you know. But, you know, that's a joke. But here, if, you know, the war fever kind of takes over, and the idea in Best for Peace, we always say wars are easy to start and hard to stop. Well, the reason they're hard to stop is that they compound, and before you know it, people are forced to take sides, and, you know, and suddenly, you know, there's this thought that runs across America that somehow if somebody's working for Russian propaganda TV, that they're, you know, against America and should be censored. Well, I don't know if that's wise or should be the case at all, but I can understand why it's happening, because this is what happens when wars are generated and, you know, people are forced to take a side, you know, and, you know, even us blabbing here about it, we're sort of carving out a certain side versus this whole radical idea of a bloody war with bombings and artillery just ripping up apartment houses and, you know, killing pregnant women and their babies on camera, you know, and it's just, it's just a god-awful mess that can only get deeper and deeper and worse before it gets better. And you know, this idea of deciding to censor people in institutions is just part of it, you know, and that's my feeling anyway. Because the arguments I'm having with people, especially in Veterans for Peace and groups like them, having arguments over the last 2 weeks in three venues on this stuff. And my point is, as a veteran for peace, I don't want to be pushed into taking sides on this. I want to be for peace, you know. The idea, maybe that's a diplomatic role rather than an activist role. I don't know. You know, but the point is, I think, you know, you can work in this racket, I call a racket, either trying to figure out a way to cease and desist this killing and destruction so that you can sit down and say, okay, let's talk about this. You have a point, we have a point, yada, let's chew it over seriously instead of killing each other. What was that? Are we still on?
Yeah.
Mike?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I heard a strange noise.
Yeah, you're...
I
wanted to give you some more examples of corporate
But you got, Hank, I think you understand kind of my drift here, that what I'm saying.
Yeah, well, we have a big responsibility, and you're the best voice we've got on so far on Radio Free Kansas about seeking some sort of peaceful road right now,
which
encompasses.
Exactly.
You're in it, but it's placing ourselves in a rock and a hard place.
Right.
Remember
well,
that one.
Exactly.
The rock and a hard place.
You're rock and a hard place.
Yeah, I was double checking. I was clicking, and it sort of, you probably overheard it, but I was double checking. But the latest scuttlebutt on more corporate media is that. The documentary by Oliver Stone, Ukraine on Fire, on Netflix, has been pulled.
Right.
And
it's
Oliver Stone's a series of interviews. Yep, it's off. And I'm going to double check here. I was double checking.
Yeah, because all the people I've been arguing with are telling me that's what I need to watch. Yeah.
And the documentary that Stone's, I think it's a 3 or 4 part documentary of Stone interviewing Putin has been pulled also.
Really?
So, I mean, it's a big deal.
I don't advocate that. I think we need to listen to everything. But that's the thing. You know, these people that I'm going round and round and round and round with, they're the ones who are telling me, oh, I need to watch Oliver Stone's piece, this piece you're talking about. And I watched a bit of it, okay? I get it. You know, I didn't watch it all, frankly. But these are the same people that religiously, I mean, seriously, religiously, will not even look at something like the New York Times or cable news or, you know, all of this information stuff. And so, you know, well, if you're only watching Oliver Stone's movie as your source on this, you know, you're getting a very skewed position, because Oliver Stone is a wonderful filmmaker. I've met him and talked to him once, and, you know, he's a wonderful filmmaker. You know, rooted in his experiences in Vietnam. Of course, his father was a, you know, big stockbroker in New York. He made Wall Street and all that, critical of Wall Street. And but he's a volatile filmmaker. He's not an objective filmmaker. You know, in other words, Stone is a partisan in some of this stuff. You know, he's a guy who comes out of the infantry in Vietnam. You know, he's not messing around. You know, so he's Oliver Stone. This is who he is. You know, he's a voice, a very important voice, but it doesn't mean you have to subscribe to everything he says 100% and get in line. You know what I mean? It just means he's a voice, and he's speaking a certain truth. But, you know, how that translates into power in our world is where we have to think about it. You know, at least that's my view anyway. So, you know, I wouldn't censor Oliver Stone at all. I wouldn't censor him, but I would address what he said, and I would do as I did with these people. Yeah. I would have discussions with them and say, listen, do you understand what you're fucking saying here? You know, oh, no, I don't. And that's the only reason you're saying this, John, is you read the New York Times. You're going like, but I also look at The Nation. You know, I look at a lot of things.
Yeah.
And, you know, it goes round and round and round, and you know, you just keep running around and around and around, you know. And it's just the nature of our times with so much information.
Yeah,
you have to be selective, or else you'll be drowned, you know.
Yeah, so I was double-checking that, and it says, this is from the Focus, .news, it says, Oliver Stone's Ukraine on Fire isn't on Netflix, but here's where. And this is 4 days ago, and it says that it's it looks like they put it on. This is weird. I mean, only in America and only U.S. corporate dominated media can do this kind of weird. It's streamed on other platforms. It's They've moved it. They've moved it. Netflix has pulled it, and they've moved it. It is certainly not available in 7 European countries. The ones that are not in NATO, it's not. It's,
have
they're
you
not, it's banned there?
Have you seen what is it? Ukraine on Fire? What's it called?
That's the actual name. And here's another interesting manipulation. Another film has been put on Netflix. It's called Winter on Fire.
I was just about to mention that film. I've seen it. I've seen part of it twice because my wife wanted to watch it. And, Well, of course, they're very different. The Winter on Fire, which I recommend to people to see, it's on Netflix. That is a classic documentary of the events of 90 days in, you know, December, January, February, you know, of 2014 in Maiden Square, and all the, you know, bloody kind of exchanges. I mean, there were hundreds, thousands of people at the police and all this. This is what those on the left, the far left, some of our colleagues, and people like Tucker Carlson on the right, all of these people say, you know, that that this was a, quote, coup, right? That the United States mm-hmm. pushed all this, you know, Virginia Nuland or whatever her name was, and, you know, she was caught on camera, on tape, you know, talking about setting up, you know, like, let's push with this guy, that guy, you know, and, like, under the table, smoke-filled room stuff. And so the right and the left, far right, far left, have agreed that this is a coup, quote, coup that the United States initiated, completely ignoring this 90 days activities on the street with all these people, you know, going nose to nose with some of the most brutal cops you could ever imagine. And in the end, Yanka Schnickelfleisch, or whatever his name is, that's a terrible thing for me to say, I can't never pronounce his name, he left. Now, what did he leave because of Newland's shenanigans under the table here, or did he leave because there was hundreds of thousands of people who persisted at being, after being sniped at and shot and gassed and beaten with clubs, still persisted on coming out en masse? Now, which of those two factors, the mob, the persistent, determined mob that suffered brutality but did not fade or leave, or Virginia Nuland, her shenanigans on the phone, you know, playing big woman on campus here all of a sudden, you know, I don't know. You
well,
know,
she
it's
picked,
a little
she,
of both,
picked,
probably.
It, wait, it wasn't just big woman. She picked the next president on the phone. She got that right because she was doing it. She was picking the next president.
What do you mean
That's
she picked
the
next president? She picked Zelensky or what?
She picked the next president of Ukraine at that time when she did that.
Well, I understand that. I understand that. This, you know, this is the way the world works. You know, you have top-down, bottom-up stuff always mixing up, you know. And so it seems to me, you know, people skew information to their partisan interests. And the point is there's an interest on the far left and the far right. They both see it together, pretty much, you know, certain elements of the right, certain elements of the left, as a, quote, insidious coup on the part of, you know, manipulative United States and the deep evil of the United States, which, you know, I've written about for many years, as causing this downfall of Yanukovych, when you can also argue with, you know, Winter on Fire, that documentary, instead of arguing on the other side, you use the Oliver Stone story, which also has on fire and in the you know, there's a fire here in both these movies.
It's confusing, isn't it? It is.
You know, but this is the nature of our times. I'm trying to say it's so goddamn confusing with the tsunami of information we get from all directions. You know, we're drowning and flooding with flotsam and jetsam and flow, you know, cars and bookcases and, you know, dressers coming, you know, kitchen cabinets and things coming down in this flood, this tsunami. You know, we're overwhelmed with all this information. So you selectively pick what goes along with your preconceived ideas of partisan views, and that's happening. So it's not ironic, it's probably coincidental. We have two films in opposing views. One is, you know, Oliver Stone suggesting there's an insidious, quote, coup, which ignores, you know, the people in the street, or suggests that people in the street are Nazis. And I don't doubt for a minute that there were some Nazis in there, you know. There's Nazis everywhere these days. You know, they're in everybody's woodwork and closets, you know. And so, you know, it's so we have two partisan views, and which one are you going to subscribe to, or are you going to be able to back up enough and be quote, objective enough, if you will, to say, well, maybe it's a little of both, and maybe history is messy, and, you know, this is what's happening. You know, maybe, you know, some people see Ukraine as a sovereign nation, and some people insist that it's not, that it's only a, quote, insurgency vis-a-vis the Russians that they have to clean out, you know, the same way that Abraham Lincoln cleaned out the Confederacy, and, you know, we cleaned out ISIS and all this. You know, so it's all in how you look at this war, and partisan views are obviously polarized and extremely different because it's a war. And, you know, this is why we need to stop the killing so we can sit down and decide, you know, sort out the mess. But, you know, once it's started, you can't do that until people get weary of war. The thing to me, I learned this in El Salvador for sure, but the most important thing that finally ends wars is stalemate. People get so goddamn weary of the killing that they sort it out. That's what they did in El Salvador. I mean, they still hate each other, you know, the rich and the poor, but they decided, well, we're not going to win this, either side, so we better just stop it. It's bad for both sides. Well, that takes a long time to get there sometimes, you know, so, you know, in Ukraine, we're not there by a long shot. So now everybody's in the pissing contest mode of, you know, parsing up their sides and backing off and demonizing the other side and saying, oh, no, the only way to understand it is to watch Oliver Stone's Ukraine on Fire. And, of course, others are saying, well, the only way to watch it is to watch Winter on Fire. Then you get the answer.
Right.
You know, it's, here we are, you know. It's like a Tower of Babel. Anyway, that's my riff on
now,
it.
Now, Winter...
know?
Yeah, well, it's a good riff for the listeners to consider. Winter on Fire, Ukraine's Fight for Freedom, is available on I think it's still available.
It's on Netflix. I've watched it on Netflix, yeah.
Yeah, but Ukraine
on Fire. And I think politically,
politically,
Netflix or YouTube will not trash that because they're just taking the established American line. You know, they're not being objective or neutral in here. They're assuming a sort of a pro-Ukraine American government posture here, you know, in this potential World War III situation, you know. I think that the best thing here that's going to prevent World War III is China, is this idea that China does not want World War III. Please, we were talking about, I think, the catbird seat. You mentioned it. You know, they're in the catbird seat. China feels that, hey, we're doing just fine here. We have to, quote, inscrutably maneuver through this thing, and we will come out smelling like a rose while the United States and Russia, you know, whether it's economic embargoes or blowing up apartments in our ally Ukraine, you know, we're going to just batter each other for a while. And it's going to further contribute to American decline because American decline is a fact of life. You know, it's not something that Donald Trump could change by wearing a goddamn red hat that says Make America Great Again. You know, it's not that simple. You know, I mean, America is a long history, and it's you know, like Aristotle's idea of tragedy and Shakespeare and tragedy, you know, your downfall is often foreseen, if you will, in the decisions one makes. And if one insists on, like, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., drug wars, persistence of all these ridiculous, wasteful things, you know, we're hosing out our national resources and treasures on these absolutely unnecessary and tragic wars. And so, you know, we're pissing out our treasure, and we're wondering why we're in decline. Well, you know, you do, you know, you make these decisions, and, you know, it's a tragic world, and, you know, it, you know, you
well, I mean,
what goes around comes around.
More tragedy.
Yeah,
well, that could sit, that cliche could sit where very neatly with the fact that mm-hmm. it's a historical fact that Ukraine,
yeah.
as part of the, when the Soviet Union collapsed,
right.
part of the deal was that the Soviet Union stiff-armed them in a way. They signed a treaty,
right.
An agreement with Ukraine. Okay,
right.
as it was imploding, Russia signed an agreement. And since they owned and built and set up the factories to make them, there was well over 1,000 nuclear
right.
warheads and missiles in
sure.
Ukraine.
Right.
And they
gave
them
up.
And
right.
let the Russians haul them back to Russia. But the
right.
thing is, now you have people around Zelensky saying
mm-hmm.
that they, you know, it's like this was the biggest mistake they'd ever made, giving the nuclear bomb
yeah.
to Russia.
Well, it's interesting. I think that's a really, really interesting academic question, but they don't have them anymore, so it's academic, right?
But the forces around them, by the way, Ray McGovern, listeners,
mm-hmm.
loyal listeners who know Ray McGovern, he has just tweeted saying that Maripol has not necessarily fallen. These are my words, but he's saying
right.
that it has. It's basically surrendered. They've opened up humanitarian corridors to the east. Now in Maripol,
right.
Maripol is considered by the Russians as the headquarters of the Azov or fascist battalions
right.
that have infiltrated the government and the National Guard. And McGovern's saying that it's been he didn't use the word fall, but he's
mm-hmm.
saying that it's basically the Russians have taken it. And that thing, I don't know, people
huh?
Geographically challenged Americans we get to
mm-hmm.
learn world history or world geography by the
right.
wars we are involved in or the new. Maripol is far from Odessa. It may appear that. They're going to negotiate keeping the Donetsk region, which is basically the Crimea and a large part of eastern Ukraine, but they're not going to be able to get to Odessa to conquer it. And they may be giving up, I'm talking about the Russians, and they may be giving
mm-hmm.
up Kiev, too. Their negotiations is
right.
like, okay, you can have Odessa as the one seaport on the south,
right.
maybe,
right.
and Kiev. Which is, in my view, it's like a Paris of Eastern Europe.
Sure.
I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful town. Who
right,
would want to
right.
see it absolutely turned into rubble? Maybe Zelensky
right.
will capitulate that with the guarantee that they won't
right.
join NATO. I don't know. I'm just
yeah.
saying McGovern.
Well, I think
that
there has to be a negotiated position. That will work for the long haul here because, you know, there is Grozny in Chechnya to consider as, you know, I don't think their invasion of Ukraine is at that level yet. I think they have a long way to go before they end up the way they, quote, won in Grozny in Chechnya. But they may not want to or need to do that in their own. In other words, the fact that Putin has stumbled his way in so, you know, brutally and, you know, like with big boots stomping around in Ukraine, blowing all those apartment buildings up and, as they say, killing pregnant women and their mothers right on camera, you know, that, you know, with pressure from China, especially in places like that, you know, they may have to say, well, look, we'll cut our losses. This is as far as we're going. We have really brutalized Ukraine and wrecked a lot of it. We've set it back quite a bit. And now we can negotiate some things like independence for those two provinces in the east, and the fact that Crimea has long been considered a Russian territory, especially with this long historical need or search of Russia for warm water ports and things like that. You know, that Ukraine would give up, you know, Crimea. You know, I remember reading Tolstoy back there. I mean, he was stationed in Crimea. He wrote stories about the Russian army in Crimea, you know, back in the old days. So it has a long history there. So what I'm saying is that Russia will have made its gesture in the world, especially vis-a-vis the United States. I think it effectively scared the living shit out of the United States, this idea that, I mean, how many times have we really, the Cuban Missile Crisis, I suppose, but how many times have we really thought, like, oh, my God, this could be nuclear Armageddon we're talking about, you know? And so this is a very serious aspect.
You ask a question. I want to answer. Not enough. Americans don't get it. The world is in spite of America. They don't even. I truly believe that many of the people in the world no longer care what America does.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I think you're right. There is something to that. Yeah, absolutely. We've caused that by our behavior. As I say, this is, you know, how tragedy happens. It all piles up. You know, people remember. We like to forget. That's what you're suggesting. You know, the Sergeant Schultz sort of phenomena. I see nothing. You know. I mean, we have instituted that into our souls, if you will. You know, we sit here, like in my, looking out the window here, my suburban cul-de-sac here with all these cookie-cutter houses back in the 50s. You know, we have our little suburban house, and we sit in it, we watch our TV, we do everything that we do in this lifestyle. And, you know, like something like Ukraine is just not part of our shtick. Unless, you know, we go out of our way, like me or you or, you know, might be interested in it.
Right.
But most people, you know, they just, you know, that's why it's the economy, stupid, was always the point. Look, you know, it's
right.
The bread and circus. The people want their bread and circus, you know.
Well, I want to add to that a little bit on a similar scale. I have secret agents everywhere. Listeners, I have secret agents everywhere. And
secret
I got
agent,
one that's in Johnson County. I got one at Johnson County. He's a loyal listener and supporter. And he lives smack dab in probably one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in the suburbs out there. Now, all of Johnson County, there are class divisions there too, don't get me wrong. But basically the newer developments, the real McMansions, you know, drive through on our way to Kansas City. There's just acres and acres and acres of these really nice, I mean, really, really, really nice houses.
You know? Oh, yeah, I know.
And
everywhere,
Yeah, that's exactly, I mean, they're not like yours, you know, which are like cookie-cutter 50s. That's
Well, no, this is like Levittown. Yeah. This was a development made after World War II. The McMansions are now being made everywhere, like mushrooms over the country. And, of course, we have McMansions, but we don't get low-income housing. Hello?
And this guy knows his neighbors. He is an institution in this cul-de-sac, you might say. It is a cul-de-sac. These are houses that go for $250,000. Let's put a price on it. $250,000 and up, okay? And he's been in this house for over, well, I want to say 15 years. I'm sure 10, okay? Forever in today's world. And he's a bachelor. He's a bachelor. Now he's divorced, and he has kids, and he and his wife have a very equitable relationship. I mean, in terms of his neighbors see him taking care of his kids, and they have a little swimming pool or something, and he talks to the neighbors, and he's found this thing, one that it's all Republicans. Where everywhere he lives out there, all of his neighbors are Republicans, and except for the women, really want to talk to him. Now there's two responses. The Trump men get jealous, okay, because they're constantly worrying. Their sex territory
insecurity
is being
up the wazoo. There, I can talk.
Yeah, if not Democrat, they probably registered Republican women. They will listen. They will listen to him.
Well, that's
because he's encouraging
them. Women. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Women are nurturers. This is why
it's imponderable.
What'd you say?
It's imponderable. It's one of those things.
Imponderable, yeah.
I remember reading
Malraux on these great books that he wrote, the Frenchman Andre Malraux, and the one that stuck that men see, and the way he put it, I forget the context, was men see life in death, the irony of death makes them want to get out and get it right. It scares the shit out of them so much they're get out and kick ass in the world. Whereas women see life in children, in babies, and things that need nurturing and bringing out life in them. You know what I mean? So men are just basically killers. That's a reductive thing to say, but.
Women are.
Malraux was really on to something.
Lovers.
Yeah,
I think he might be. But my secret agent in Johnson County, he says. But the thing is, in response to the Ukraine, so he gets to study these people really well. I teach him about how are the Republican lab rats doing out there? In the high suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
And he will joke with me about it. And he said this is the one thing that all of them united with, women, men, they're all freaked out about their goddamn gasoline prices. That's
there
the
you
common
go.
Thing.
You got
it's
McCarthy in the house.
It's unbelievable.
Well, you got McCarthy in the house, this son of a bitch Republican in the house, saying that this is Biden's gas hike. And Biden says, well, fuck you. No, it's Putin's gas hike. And, of course, what's his name? The great economist, my brain fart here, Paul Krugman, today has a column about that. Is this Putin's gas hike or is it Biden's gas hike? Well, obviously, if you're a Republican, there's no question it has to be Biden's. Or, I'm sure Hunter's involved with it as well, this is just the nature of partisan politics, they probably blame Bo.
Economics.
He's dead, the point is, but you take an economist here who does have a Nobel Prize,
yeah.
Look,
uh-huh.
you know, Putin mucks up the whole thing here, the whole oil system, and we put him on, you know, on all these embargo things. Well, of course gas is going to go up. Duh. You know, it's like...
Right.
But this is why the bullshit comes out, you know. It's like the partisan bullshit, generated bullshit. You know, it's like you can't get a straight answer in today's modern world, because you get a straight answer, there's going to be 16 other bullshit answers that are going to pop at you, and they're going to go, well, I don't know, maybe, before you know it, I have no idea what's going on, you know. And this is the condition we live in.
I know. Some of my agents are listening, and they, we don't have enough
your
time
secret
to
agent?
Put you on.
Well, you should use Johnny, what's his name? Johnny, the great musician from the 70s, his secret agent man, you know. You should use that as your theme. Secret agent.
The network will probably... but my network would probably get me for copyright infringement, and I'm always walking on eggshells with the network.
Well, hey, I know that feeling.
Anyhow,
absolutely.
Yeah, so I have to chop it up, or so I'd have to.
But I like your idea of secret agents out there. I like that.
They're everywhere. They literally are I can see when they call up, and that don't put your hands up. You can't come on. That's the one. Isn't that interesting? The contradictions. The women, of the women have an open ear, and the men are literally. And these are not poor men. These guys got guns and shit. And worried.
Yeah.
He's always worried. He's worried about pissing off the guys too much. So he's up front with them, but he's not. You know, he's not going to pick a fight, an argument with him over the barbecue grill. But
well, this is why I've always said we need women in this anti-war peace movement. We need the idea of the nurturance of women to somehow be allowed to factor into this discussion. But instead, we get all this women's movement stuff. They want power, and so they end up like Hillary Clinton, just being a male with a vagina. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's like, I don't, you know.
Hey, that's a great question. Hillary Clinton. Your line on Hillary Clinton is great. That's great.
A man with a vagina. You like
she's
that?
She's a dickhead.
I'm just trying to make a point here quickly. I know the show's closing up, but I think the guy's really onto something, what I'm saying. I think women are, in a way, the secret to all this. But somehow that nurturance, that gentle maternal nurturance, which translates into Freud's idea of Eros versus Thanatos, the death instinct, the life instinct, and all that. This is really deep, deep stuff. But the problem is that male killer instinct tends to trump the women's thing. And I mean that a pun there. That is a pun, intentional, you know. This is a... This is why the Trump movement is full of angry men, you know.
Well, speaking of a male institution, I mean, here we have Zelensky, president of Ukraine,
right?
Five eyes on some gigantic Zoom call coming up here this week. He's allegedly going to come on and speak to a joint House of Congress.
Yeah.
This is like elevating this guy to comedian.
Well, Congress doesn't want to be, you know, one-upped by, you know, Britain. He spoke already in the Britain legislature. You know, I mean,
he wants these jet fighters. I mean, he ran as a peace candidate and won. Man. Now he wants these Soviet jet fighters from Poland.
Well, I mean, they are sort of tearing up his country, you know. I mean, come on. I think if I were him, I'd want jets too, you know.
Surrender now, fight later. That's what I think. That's where I'm at.
Okay, good. Surrender now and then become a guerrilla force. Okay. You know.
Yeah, or what's that? I mean, something.
God. Or you remember that old book and movie with Peter Sellers, The Mouse That Roared? You know, the little country that decided, let the United States crush us, and then they can build us up, and we'll be better off afterwards. You know.
Okay.
The mouse that roared.
What
else would
he
do?
Ukraine. Yeah.
What's that?
Right, the rest of us could see it as a pleasant little song.
Here we go. This is
Joyce saw in it
the
entire cycle of
life. We're St. Patrick's, the real St. Patrick's
Day.
Okay.
Hey. Here we go. Finnegan's Wake. John Grant with Finnegan's
Wake. Hey, Mike.
Finnegan walked the street, a gentle Irishman, mighty odd. He had a role for rich and sweet, and a ride in the world he carried on. You see, in a sort of a different way, with a lot of like a fortune was born. You had the man with his work each day, he was robbed the treasure every morn. One morning Tim felt rather full, his head felt heavy, which made him shake. He fell from the ladder and he broke his skull, and they carried him home as corpse to wake. They rolled him up in a nice clean sheet, and they laid him out upon the bed, with a bucket of whiskey at his feet and a bottle of porter at his head. What for the ladder, his friends assembled at the wake, and Mrs. Finnegan called for lunch. First she brought in tea and cake, then pipes, tobacco and whiskey punch. Minnie O'Brien began to cry, such a nice clean corpse did you ever see? Tim McBonin, why did you die, or shut your mouth, Miss Patty McGee? What for the dad of this dear partner was the glory of Surrey? What is this? Maggie O'Connor took